This is Ozarks at Large for Monday afternoon, September 9th, 2019, on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ahead on our show, the many different avenues a discussion about church and state can take. The University of Arkansas Honors College will offer a signature seminar about church and state next semester, and the professor leading that course, Mark Killenbeck from the U of A School of Law, will help us navigate some of the routes the conversation has taken over the past two centuries in the United States. He'll also deliver a preview lecture Wednesday on campus. In the spirit of public discussion, the Bentonville Public Library is hosting sessions for younger patrons about debate and creating arguments. The meetings take place at the library every other Monday, including today, from 4 to 6, and are intended for students in grades 5 through 8. The program is free and requires no registration, though seating is limited. BentonvilleLibrary.org for more information. After today's Ozarks, it's NPR's Here and Now. This afternoon, Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar wants to be president, and she's pitching herself as a moderate who can unite the country. A continuation of conversations with candidates next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston, beginning today at 1. And your gift during KUAF's fundraising month in September pays for all the news, music, and entertainment programs you enjoy and rely on. Make your gift now to support everything you hear on KUAF at supportkuaf.com. This is Ozarks at Large. The new nonprofit Arkansas Immigrant Defense in Springdale provides legal aid to immigrant asylum seekers detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement for attempting to cross the southern border. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich spoke recently with two staff members at the new facility, and she brings us this report.
Arkansas Immigrant Defense is located in a spacious two-story red brick building in North Springdale on East Wagon Wheel Road just off I-49. The nonprofit law firm is staffed with two attorneys, including Director Stephen Koger, founder of the Arkansas Justice Collective, and five specialists, including a social worker. Michelle Rangel is an authorized executive office of immigration review specialist.
So as we are helping various individuals who are arriving to the U.S. for the first time, have been processed at the border, a lot of them will have either pending or scheduled immigration court. And so we help them with that process as well. And my job is to kind of learn how to help us navigate that world of immigration court.
Arkansas Immigrant Defense works with Memphis Immigration Court, which is under the jurisdiction of the Office of the Chief Immigration Judge, a component of the Department of Justice's Executive Office for Immigration Review. The number of migrants arrested at the southwest border seeking asylum in the U.S. peaked at nearly 133,000 last spring, the highest number in a decade, according to recent ICE data. In late June, the Associated Press reported grave conditions inside one Texas migrant detention facility, holding 250 infants, children, and teens, separated from families under a Trump administration mandate. But August saw a sharp decline with Border Patrol arrests numbering only 51,000. Myra Esquivel, a paralegal at Arkansas Immigrant Defense, says immigration attorneys in Arkansas collaborate to help such migrants seek asylum in the state.
So the mission for this nonprofit law firm is to promote justice in Arkansas, and we do that by defending and advancing the rights of immigrants and refugees through our direct legal services and community education and community advocacy.
Arkansas Immigrant Defense also collaborates with refugee resettlement agencies Canopy and Catholic Immigration Services based in Little Rock and is cultivating a relationship with the Bail Project, a nonprofit which partners with public defenders and local nonprofits to identify people in pretrial detention who cannot afford cash bail. Arkansas Immigrant Defense has just constructed a new website and is conducting public outreach.
So right now we have a Facebook page. We also have some flyers that we had made or just made.
And we're going to be dispersing those here very soon around different Latinx and immigrant businesses.
Esquivel says most of their clients are youth, some who cross the border seeking asylum with family or on their own, most with few to no resources. Arkansas Immigrant Defense is supported by major donors, including the Denver Foundation and the New American Campaign, as well as private donors. The annual operating budget is $190,000.
Our main focus is undocumented youth or children, and our services to them, which is a special program that we're really trying to inform the community about, special immigrant juvenile status. And for that, we don't charge. It's free, basically, our legal services. For adults, we do function on a sliding fee scale.
Michelle Rangel says ICE refers young migrants detained at border facilities or shelters who have sponsors in Arkansas, primarily relatives, to Arkansas Immigrant Defense.
We are on a list of legal service providers that they are given whenever they are released, if they are released with a family member or someone that can care for them. And that's essentially how they find us. And they're always very grateful to learn that we offer those services for free for their children. And then we, you know, try to figure out what the best relief is for them and start to get them on that pathway.
Arkansas Immigrant Defense staff travel the state to where migrants are to provide legal services. Myra Esquivel says demand for services remains high.
We are working with around 200 cases, and most of them are from Northwest Arkansas, but it also surrounding areas like Green Forest, Decatur, surrounding areas.
Arkansas Immigrant Defense also provides low-cost naturalization counseling. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And an open house for Immigration Defense is scheduled for tomorrow evening from 5:30 to 7. Last week, by the large cross on Mount Sequoia in Fayetteville, a collection of pastors, priests, ministers, and representatives from area nonprofit organizations announced the Northwest Arkansas Sanctuary Network, a partnership pledging to stand with immigrants who are threatened by deportation for reasons that are termed unfair by the new group. Pastor Clint Schneckloth, lead pastor at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Fayetteville and a frequent guest on Ozarks at Large, announced the intentions of the organizations.
Members of the coalition pledged to stay engaged in the short term by providing a safe harbor for immigrant neighbors or supporting those faith communities who are providing shelter. For the long term, coalition supporters are united in advocacy efforts that can bring comprehensive immigration reform to this country.
Some of the congregations currently open for sanctuary include Good Shepherd and St. Paul's Episcopal and Rolling Hills Baptist in Fayetteville and All Saints Episcopal in Bentonville. Reverend Sarah Milford with All Saints says more than half of the congregation there is from outside of the contiguous United States, mostly from Central America.
To think that any one of them could be susceptible to deportation or harassment or prejudice or anything that happens to people of color was just not how we uphold the dignity of our fellow human beings and our neighbors. And so it's just a no-brainer.
The official statement handed out at the press conference last week expresses a goal of also working for public awareness of who is in sanctuary, why they are there, and what can be done about their cases. Caleb Graves, the student and community minister at Rolling Hills Baptist Church in Fayetteville, says it was important for his congregation to support the program.
We have a number of people that we minister to on a regular basis who are part of the Hispanic community, including many that we know of who are undocumented. It would be hypocritical of us and a double face to be willing to minister publicly in a way that's easy and then turn around when somebody came to us for sanctuary and for help to simply turn them away.
The pledge created by the Northwest Arkansas New Sanctuary Network can be found at nwasanctuary.org. And just ahead on Ozarks, the ever-evolving relationship between church and state.
Why did they flee England? The established church. So they come to America to establish religious freedom. And what did they immediately do? They established a church.
A preview of an Honors College seminar about church and state begins in under a minute on Ozarks at Large.
91.3 is supported by Clubhouse Fitness, striving to help Arkansas become one of the healthiest states in the nation by offering personal training, over 70 classes weekly, and access to outdoor activities. located on Dixon Street and on Joyce Boulevard in Fayetteville, plus Little Rock, and online at clubhausfitness.com. Savor the Flavor is a self-guided restaurant, food, and beverage sampling tour and is happening in downtown Bentonville Thursday, September 19th. This Faith in Action fundraiser helps provide non-medical services to homebound seniors. Tickets are still available at 444-9888.
We've been trying to figure out the relationship between church and state in this country since Europeans first arrived. And Mark Hillenbeck is fascinated with the history of church and state. Next semester, he'll lead an Honors College signature seminar about the subject at the University of Arkansas. Killenbeck has been on the U of A law faculty since 1998, and there he teaches courses on the Constitution, the First Amendment, and American constitutional history. While the seminar isn't until 2020 and is for students in the Honors College, the public has a chance to hear him give a free preview lecture Wednesday at 5:15 p.m. in the Gearhart Hall Auditorium on the U of A campus. Recently, Mark Hillenbeck came to the Carver Center for Public Radio to discuss church and state. He says there are distinct challenges for coming to a consensus about that relationship.
Everybody's conception of the proper relationship of church and state grows out of what they grew up with. No matter how you feel about other aspects of life or the government or Constitution, every single person has a position on religion. You have it. You have it in various degrees, you have it in various types, or you don't. And so it's intensely personal, and it's intensely local. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that we have a constitution that is not put in place to structure local relationships. It's put in place to structure a national polity and to set up some sort of relationship between government and private institutions with a preferred position, there is no doubt of it, a preferred position for religion.
Has the countries, and since everyone has their own opinion or their own boundaries, but have things changed over time?
That's the second complicating factor. One of the founding myths, we've got the Doughty Pilgrims coming across the Atlantic, actually from Holland, not from England, because they had to flee England. Why did they flee England? The established church. So they come to America to establish religious freedom. And what did they immediately do? They established a church. They created a structure that mirrored the one they fled in England. And if you go back and look at the time the Constitution was framed, at least 9 and arguably 11 of the original 13 states all had established religions. Hmm. Probably the most liberal one was in Massachusetts, ironically, where it was local option. If you lived in Plymouth, it could be Church X. If you lived in Salem, Church Y. But they replicated exactly what they decided to flee. Second complicating historical factor is that in 1791, when the First Amendment is ratified, this nation is virtually universally Christian. Religious tolerance meant, okay, you're a X, an Episcopalian. I'm a Lutheran. I'll put up with you. But, of course, then there was Maryland with those troublesome Catholics.
Right, right.
And that has been the challenge. The evolution of the government and the court's conception of church and state has been deeply stressed by the diversification of the nation. Once you start getting immigration in the late 19th century, and in particular when you start getting it from places other than Europe, even Eastern Europe, you start getting it from around the world, you start to bring in a whole raft of religious beliefs and systems that, shall we say, mainstream Christians mm-hmm. look at as you cannot be serious. This cannot possibly be religion. At the same time, the overwhelmingly Christian population in the United States, especially in the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s, are testing the boundaries of what they can get away with in terms of placing either religion in public life or getting public support for religious activity. And that's when the Supreme Court starts to enter with a vengeance and things get messy.
And that's in the, 1950?
It begins in 1947 with a case involving riding the bus to school.
Okay.
A rather harmless program. I have absolutely no quarrel with the notion that if you're going to provide money so people can attend private schools, you don't exclude the people going to religious schools. That's outright discrimination. What happens is in New Jersey, the Catholics, and most private education back then was Catholic, had the savvy to pass a measure that said any private accredited school. And so what the Supreme Court said is this is not a help religion matter. This is a help public education matter, the Everson case. Once Everson comes down 5-4, then they start pushing the boundaries. We got this. Let's see what we can get next. And there's a whole series of cases in the 50s and 60s that lead us to where we are today.
All right. So self-referential. We all have our own opinions. We've changed since the first Europeans got here. What's the third challenge?
The court.
Oh, well.
Deeply fractured. I mean, Everson 5-4. Very few of the key religion clause decisions, be they establishment or free exercise, which we haven't even talked about yet, are 8-1, 9-0, 7-2. Virtually all of them are 6-3 with concurrences or 5-4. It's divided. They cannot agree. And it's been a continuing struggle to try and make sense of what they've been doing.
Is there also just a challenge sometimes with defining what we mean by church and what we mean by state?
Oh, what we mean by our religion.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a guy who started this thing called the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster.
You'll occasionally see the bumper stickers.
In Kansas. He boiled for our sins. People hear that. And he did it for political reasons. He was contesting the state of Kansas in its devotion to creationism. So there was no doubt it was a parody. Under Supreme Court doctrine, you could, in fact, establish a Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. All it needs to do is have the hallmarks of what we recognize as religion. It sounds weird to people. Perhaps the best example is a case that was actually litigated to the Supreme Court involving the Santerians. It's a Caribbean, people would call it a cult, not a religion. But instead of little unleavened wafers and thimbles of grape juice or wine, they sacrifice animals, little bunnies, little rabbits. City of Hialeah, Florida was horrified, and they passed a statute, a local measure that was clearly targeted to drive them out. And the Supreme Court, to its credit, said, this is a religion. This is entitled to the protection of the Constitution. But you raise the Santerians or the Spaghetti Monsters or any number of other religions, even in some quarters and some portions of this nation, Islam. And people go, no, that can't possibly be a religion. And that makes it even more fun.
And then what about definition of state? I mean, that's school, that's city council meetings, that's...
It's any... And this is one of the ironies. If you look at the text of the Constitution, there's a textualist argument that did not get traction. The First Amendment says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. It does not say make no law establishing religion. What happens with Everson is they make it establishing religion. If you look at the landscape in 1791, there is a very powerful argument that what the Constitution was saying is to Congress, you keep your hands off of religion. It's a local matter. Remember what I said earlier. Most of the states had established churches. I think a respectable historical textual argument can be made. Congress could not then pass a statute saying Alabama, Massachusetts, Arkansas, you can't have an official state religion.
I think one thing where lay people might get confused or think we know what we're talking about and don't is, well, it'll just be fair. We can put up the Ten Commandments, and then if you want to bring something from the Quran or if you want to bring something from the Spaghetti Monster, that can go up too. It'll just be everybody.
Except that then the governments fight it tooth and nail. That's what's been going on down at the state capitol, the Baphomet, people trying to get the monument down there.
Baphomet, this... Yeah. Allegedly satanic, probably tongue-in-cheek figure.
I'm not sure it completely served as tongue-in-cheek, two or three other cases in Arkansas where traditionally they had the nativity scene on the courthouse lawn. Along come the troublemakers from the ACLU. So then what the local locality does is rent a portion of the courthouse lawn to a private organization in an attempt to make it look like, no, this isn't us, this is a private entity. And the district court, to its credit, saw through that. But it's thing after thing after thing, because what are you basically appealing to? You're appealing to majority sentiment. Circle right back where we started. This is what makes this area so difficult, because people deeply feel this. And I don't doubt there's most of them. There's some I do. I don't doubt their sincerity. They are deeply offended. why can't I have my God, whatever that God might be, mm-hmm. part of my government and part of my life in that manner? I don't understand. Wasn't this nation founded on religious freedom? And my freedom to express myself should be recognized by my government, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I want to have a crucifix around my neck and I work at a courthouse or a burqa or a yarmulke. That's fine.
Depends. Depends.
I love depends.
It depends on if you can't do it if it's part of a uniform. Police officers have tried that. They've got that.
Or a football uniform or something.
You can't do it in circumstances where it looks like what you're doing is imposing your view on people. So you've got to be careful how you do it. Can you wear the crucifix or the lapel pin? Probably. Can you even have perhaps that in your office? Probably. But you got to watch what you say. You've got to watch how you counsel. There's a very, very fun case decided in the Eighth Circuit by one of my all-time favorite people, Buzz Arnold, the Arkansan Gone True, where this guy was he was a counselor on welfare benefits. And what he wanted to do was to instruct people in the proper way to get a Christian view of whether you should have welfare. Can't do that. On the other hand, they couldn't keep him from keeping a Bible in the drawer in his desk so long as he read it before work hours. Then there's Roy Moore, the punching bag. People don't remember that he got his start as a trial court judge in the backwoods of Alabama with the Ten Commandments on the wall and praying with every jury before they went out to deliberate. And when the ACLU said you couldn't do that, that's what got him elected Chief Justice of Alabama.
So let's say I'm a judge and I want the 12 jurors to consider the weight of their responsibility. Now, I can't lead them in a specific denominational prayer. Can I ask them just to take a moment and think?
You do that as part of the charge of the jury. Here is the law. Here are the facts. Think about it.
Okay.
You don't bring in anything else.
Right. Right.
Hopefully.
Same with high school football games. You've got prayers. The players say, we want to have a prayer. They huddle. It's not over the public address system. Still, if it's on a high school field, public school, whatever student is leading that shouldn't lead it in one denomination. Should he or she?
No.
Because you could be isolating or...
And part of it comes out of the history of the locality. So what happens now is the way you play the game is you try and make it look like it's purely private speech. But if it's purely private speech in a district or school system where historically they did it as an official policy, and now what they're doing is sort of farming it out, then you can get into difficulties. The proverbial bottom line is if we are going to respect the increasing diversity of the nation, we should have enough respect for everybody else to say, does this really belong here? Do we really need this overt kind of conduct?
And by saying you can't do that specifically isn't to denigrate your particular religion. It's just to say we're respecting everyone.
Yeah.
So inclusion through exclusion.
Well,
but
the irony here is we haven't talked about free exercise because that's the second part of the church and state thing. Congress shall make no law respecting establishment nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. In 1878, famous case, Reynolds, the Supreme Court was confronted with the state of Utah, which had a few quaint customs, including plural marriage. And Utah was told, no plural marriage, can't come into union with that. And in Reynolds, the court said, you're absolutely free to believe that you have a moral obligation or you will suffer eternal damnation to have multiple marriage. You simply can't act on it. Belief-conduct dichotomy. That worked because the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was a fringe Christian religion in the 1870s and remained so for much of our history. Once we began to treat free exercise as a fundamental right and give it heightened protection, and the nation got more diverse, problems arose. So in 1989, we get a new case involving Native Americans in Oregon. Once or twice a year, under carefully controlled circumstances, as part of their religion, they wanted to ingest peyote. Oregon said, no can do if you want unemployment benefits. Mm. Supreme Court, on its own, this issue was not briefed, resurrected belief conduct as part of the federal free exercise guarantee. You're absolutely free to believe, you are not free to act. Well, lots of us, including me, reacted with horror. We thought, this is bad. But as the nation became more and more diverse and we began to get more and more religions from all around the place coming in with all sorts of religious commands that ran counter to accepted criminal and civil prescriptions, it began to look like this wasn't necessarily all that bad a rule. In terms of at what point do you say, we have always treated this as an act you cannot undertake. Now you're telling me we're going to let you undertake it simply because it's part of this religious system. And it poses special problems. I mean, that is the underlying problem with Mr. The baker in Colorado, the masterpiece cake thing.
Right.
In terms of his sincere belief that he's not going to bake cakes for same-sex marriages and the notion that, sorry, we have a non-discrimination law that protects this group of people. One of the interesting things was during the 50s and 60s, litigating religions that claimed that as part of their religious system, they had a religious obligation and right to discriminate against African Americans.
Right.
And it's an interesting, I studied this for an article I wrote. The courts were deeply, deeply troubled by this. And some courts, not many, to their credit, recognized that this was in fact a religion and it was in fact a religious belief, but then elided their way around it. But the religious belief systems and the things that are forbidden by religions they're vast.
Well, you see it with the morning after pill or contraceptives. Mm-hmm. Someone might say, I don't want to hand out or offer these prescriptions because it goes against my belief system.
That's right. And that was a case that came to the court where they denied cert. They did not hear the case, prompting a relatively vigorous dissent from the denial of cert. There are lots of these issues that are lurking on the horizons. And one of the fun things I did is I said, okay, let's look at all these religions. What do religions forbid? I did not know that both in a number of religious systems, including in the Christian Bible, the Jewish Bible, and the Quran, tattoo,
mm-hmm.
forbidden. Okay, can I refute? Now, then I found a statistic that said 45% of the adult population between 18 and 65 have ink.
45%?
Wow. I hope that's not true, but that's just me old fuddy-duddy about it.
Right.
But what happens when if you walk into a department store or you walk into a restaurant and you've got ink and they refuse to serve you?
As a restaurant owner, I'm sorry. That's defacing the body.
Mm-hmm. All sorts of interesting things.
This isn't going to go away, is it?
No.
I mean, there's a good chance that you and I don't know all of the issues that 20 years from now will be involved in this, but we know there will be.
And we know there will be because what happens is, as I said earlier, the court rules. People, so to speak, bow their heads, and then they get on doing what they want to do.
Yeah.
And we litigate it, and we litigate it, and we litigate it. I want you to confront this and confront it from two perspectives. What do you believe and why? Why does it structure your life? And then what do other people believe and why do they believe it? And when those things collide, how should we respond appropriately? Should we respond appropriately with tolerance and respect, or should we respond by saying, excuse me, I want my government to adopt my view and a pox upon yours? They don't say a pox upon yours, but that's the feeling that you get. Justice Ginsburg expressed it very eloquently in her dissent in the Bladensburg case in terms of, yes, you and you think this. There are others who think otherwise. And what about them?
Mark Killenbeck is a law professor at the University of Arkansas School of Law, and he will deliver a free public lecture about church and state Wednesday at 5:15 in Gerhardt Hall Auditorium on the U of A campus. He'll lead an Honors College Signature Seminar on church and state in the spring 2020 semester. And a week from today, another preview of a 2020 Signature Seminar series, this one devoted to violence, a subject that has an unfortunate long history.
Which also raises then an issue that I think is fundamental for the study of violence, that how a society defines violence, what they consider to be violence, is something that has changed over time, and it is a construct.
Ram Natarajan gives us a preview of his signature seminar series a week from today on the Monday, September 16th edition of Ozarks at Large.
You listen to NPR News on KUAF because you trust the journalism that brings you more than the headlines. One of the roles of a free press in a democracy is to fill in the half-truths and call out falsehoods. In times like these, this kind of reporting is essential, but it's also expensive. Your gift to KUAF helps pay for the news that is vital to all of us right now, and your support during the month of September helps us toward our fall fundraising goal of $150,000. Support KUAF and NPR News right now by making a gift at supportkuaf.com.
And as of this morning, already more than $15,000 raised. Thank you. 72% of Fayetteville's city-run facilities are now operating on clean energy. Representatives from the city, Ozarks Electric Cooperative, and Today's Power Incorporated conducted a ceremonial flipping of the switch Friday morning at one of the three solar farms supplying power to the city's two wastewater treatment plants.
All right, one, two, three.
The flipping of the switch took place at the West Side Wastewater Treatment Facility, which has two solar farms, one near North Broyles Avenue and West Persimmon Street, the other near North 54th Avenue. The third farm is at the Nolan Wastewater Treatment Facility along North Fox Hunter Road. Fayetteville's Environmental Director Peter Nierengarten says it's a milestone for the city.
I mean, you know, it's one thing to talk about these types of projects, in front of city council and present plans and goals for doing things like this, but to actually see it come to fruition and, be able to flip the switch on it, and then also look at our bills and see the impact that it's making in terms of the electricity production, it's pretty exciting.
Nierengarten says aside from producing cleaner energy, for the next 20 years, the city will buy electricity generated by the arrays at a lower rate than it previously did, with expected savings of about $182,000 a year.
This really helps us stabilize our energy costs going forward, so we have a guaranteed price on the cost of our electricity over the next 20 years, which that gets passed on to citizens in terms of, not needing to raise taxes or not needing to raise rates relative to cover those costs, right? So it provides stability in operations for us, which is to the benefit of all of our citizens and the ratepayers from the water and wastewater utility, which is where this electricity will be provided.
The two wastewater treatment plants also include battery storage facilities. Nierengarten says they will store unused energy, which can then be tapped by Ozarks Electric.
What it does is it allows Ozarks in times when there's peak energy demand, which for our area happens in the summertime in the afternoon when it's hot and people are running their air conditioners. So if there's not enough electricity being produced here locally, they have to go out on the open market and buy really expensive electricity from a long ways off, right? And so these batteries allow them to reduce the amount of power they have to go off and purchase. They can deploy these batteries.
The stored energy will also be used by the treatment plants when sunlight is low. Nierengarten says this collaboration illustrates that clean energy, protecting the environment, creating jobs, and saving money can come together in a single project.
And so to me, that's really the message on this. This is not something where we had to sacrifice or give up or spend a bunch of money. I mean, we'd have to spend money, but we're going to recoup that money down the road. And so to me, that's the really important piece of it is how other communities can do this same thing to address their energy needs and save money and create cleaner air for their citizens and provide jobs. So all of that as a package is just really a win-win-win, in my opinion.
Fayetteville Mayor Lionel Jordan says the solar array project is the result of the city's adoption of an energy action plan in 2018 that calls for all city-run facilities to convert to clean energy by 2030.
The real reason this is so tremendously important, it's time for us to get off the fossil fuels. It is time that we develop clean energy, not only in this city, not only in the state, not only in the nation, but in the world. And we are able to contribute a small part of that on this day and the history of this city.
The next step is to find ways to convert the remaining 28% of city facilities to renewable energy. Peter Nierengarten says that will likely involve more solar power units, but they're looking at other forms of energy as well.
It's also looking potentially at wind power, as we have decent access to wind power over in Oklahoma, so that may be an opportunity for us as well. So we're trying to take a kind of a shotgun approach to, you know, fill in that remaining 28% gap.
This is Ozarks at Large.
What was the Apollo seismic experiment? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager with the U of A Center for Space and Planetary Science. And this is Scratching the Surface. The passive seismic experiment was conducted from the Apollo era, starting with Apollo 11. It then became redesigned and improved for the future Apollo missions. It would detect moonquakes, which would help us understand the internal structure of the moon, as well as how impact craters would affect the shaking of the ground. During the 340-hour lunar night, when temperatures can plummet to negative 274 degrees Fahrenheit, the instrument was kept to a minimum of negative 65 degrees Fahrenheit by a nuclear heater, the first major use of nuclear energy in a NASA-manned mission. More than 1,700 meteorite impacts were recorded by the seismometer network, with impactor masses estimated to be between half to over 5,000 kilograms in size. How does this compare to earthly earthquakes, though? These moonquakes are quite small, mostly with Richter scale magnitudes less than 2. A very exciting piece of research from the experiment was that below 1,000 kilometers in depth, seismic waves became immediately lessened, possibly indicating the presence of a small amount of molten rock. Hopefully, with the great design of the InSight instrument currently on Mars, we can go back to the moon with a more advanced seismometer and get more moonquakes. For more on the Center for Space and Planetary Science, or for more segments of Scratching the Surface, spacecenter.uark.edu.
Scratching the Surface with your host, Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager, is a production of 91.3 FM, KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville. This is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas.
It's Monday. It's September 9th, 2019. With me at the Carver Center for Public Radio is Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
As I say when I walk into the office every morning, hi, honey, I'm home.
You were gone for a while. On vacation, having to do some other work.
Been all over, got to spend the weekend with the grandbaby. That was super cool.
But now you're back.
I'm happy to be back.
We're happy to have you.
And I had some really great interviews last week. And one of them, I had no reason to expect to be a great interview. Laura Downs, who is coming to Crystal Bridges, mm-hmm. is a musician mm-hmm. with a great fascination for art, particularly for the art of Georgia O'Keeffe. So she's going to be talking about that and playing music. And she was absolutely delightful.
Well, good.
She said that her family teases her that she could never sit still unless it was on a piano bench, which she started at like 3 years old. And now she's considered one of the foremost American pianists of her generation. She said her dad had the big collection of vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
So she grew up listening to some of everything. And it was her mother that taught her women can be anything they want to be because her dad passed away when she was 9 mm-hmm. and mom was a single mom. She said, if you grow up with a single mom, you grow up understanding women run the world.
Yes.
And this is the absolute truth. So she thought about being an archaeologist. That may be when we clicked, because so did I. She thought it required too much patience. I thought it was outdoors and hot and dirt bugs, ooh, ick.
Yeah. Well.
So we both diverged from that. Then she went through the period where she wanted to act.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't we all? And then she found the piano. And she says she's still a huge nerd who loves finding hidden treasures in piano repertoire. And interpreting music requires a huge amount of character and drama.
So a little bit of archaeology
there. So she found all of it all together. And she will be doing three things at Crystal Bridges. On Saturday the 14th, there will be a gallery conversation on Georgia O'Keeffe at 1 p.m. She said, you know, pianists, musicians talk about color all the time in music.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't know if people understand what they mean. And she said Georgia O'Keeffe's paints what,
okay,
what they mean. Then on Sunday the 15th, she'll be part of the Van Cliburn concert series at 3 o'clock.
Right.
Tickets for that are $45 for adults. And then on Monday the 16th, she'll do a piano workshop. Call 657-2335 to find out more about the piano workshop.
All right.
And then this week.
Plenty to do.
Oh,
plenty,
yeah,
to do.
It's September. Tuesday, Authors in the Afternoon with Jimmy Jewell, author of Westward Expansion, at 4 o'clock at the Fort Smith Main Library. Books and Brews at 6 o'clock at El Sol Restaurant in Fayetteville, hosted by the Fayetteville Public Library. The book is Rules of Civility by Amor Towles. On Wednesday, Try FPL at the Fayetteville Public Library is a houseplant swap.
Oh.
And they're going to have master gardeners there to talk about plants.
Okay.
On Thursday, it's Art on the Bricks in Rogers. And this time, the Rogers Historical Museum has an exhibit open for Art on the Bricks. It's works by landscape artist and Rogers native Charles Summey from 4:30 to 6:30. At Arkansas Public Theater is a new exhibition of parts of Men with Earrings.
Oh, John Rankin.
Photographs of Eurekans by John Rankin. That's from 4:30 to 6:30. It's paired with the Rocky Horror Picture or the Rocky Horror Show on stage, which opens on Friday.
Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Yes, yeah, we were born in Arkansas. DeWitt, Arkansas.
DeWitt,
Arkansas. That was a long time ago, 1930. Yeah, January the 24th, 1930. In fact, there's a big snow on my grandmother's head. But I'm going to take her word for it.
The Armstrong twins, Floyd and Lloyd Armstrong, were born in Arkansas County. The Armstrong family moved to Little Rock in 1933. They grew up in a musical family with their mother Lois proficient on piano, auto harp, and ukulele. She appeared on Little Rock station KLRA as part of the duo The Sunshine Girls. The Armstrong twins made an appearance on a children's television show on Little Rock's KARK and landed a regular slot on a Saturday morning talent show on the same station. The oldest of five children, Floyd and Lloyd also appeared with their eldest sister as the Armstrong twins and Patsy in California, but she later left music to start a family.
Say, Lloyd, what's that you're picking on that mandolin?
Why, Floyd, that's a mandolin rag. Get with me, son.
Yeah, let's go.
Originally, the brothers both played guitar and sang as their act, but Lloyd, who sang harmony, switched to mandolin in 1938. He later said he just picked out the instrument by chance.
Well, Mother taught us to
harmonize when we were 5 years old.
And I played the guitar until I was about 8 or 9, I guess about 8 years old. And then Daddy took me over to North Little Rock one time, I'll never forget it, and took me to the Square Deal Pawn Shop. Daddy took me over there and had me to pick something out, had a whole row up on cot. I said, I'll take that little thing right there. Didn't even know what it was. It was a mandolin, and it's a wonder that I hadn't picked a tuba or something. It just happened that a mandolin goes with a guitar. That's what I picked out, and I took the mandolin up, and then Floyd started playing the guitar.
The Armstrongs moved to California to pursue music success when the twins were still young teens. They were soon heard on programs hosted by Spade Cooley, Cliffy Stone, and Mena, Arkansas native T. Texas Tyler. Tyler was signed to 4-Star Records of Pasadena, California. T. Texas Tyler was the first country performer signed to the struggling label, and he found success. Soon, other country music artists, such as the Maddox Brothers and Rose, Webb Pierce, and yes, the Armstrong twins, had releases on 4-Star. The Armstrongs' first record was a version of Arkansas native Carolina Cotton's autobiographical song, 3 Miles South of Cash in Arkansas. During this time, the Armstrong twins also appeared on powerful Mexican border radio stations, such as XELO, XERF, and XERB. The twins would perform on their own show with other 4-Star artists as special guests, such as T-Texas Tyler, and in turn would be special guests on Tyler's radio show. The Armstrongs cut several singles for 4-Star Records, but did not pursue recording as much as live performances.
We done 9 releases with 4-Star, 18 sides. Of course, that's certainly not a record, but we should have or could have made more records, I guess. Of course, 4-Star sold out, too.
Yeah.
They quit recording out there, and Dad and Mom moved back here, and we'd follow them, naturally. We went down to the Hayride and was on that for a while. Elvis is on there, Sonny James.
Bird will be singing.
In 1950, the twins moved from California to Texas and again hosted radio programs and appeared on local television. They continued performing throughout the 1960s and released a single on Wayne Rainey's Rimrock Records of Concord, Arkansas, but retired from professional music in 1969. Floyd worked as a mechanic and Lloyd as a carpenter through the 1970s. The twins reunited musically in 1979. A June performance that year at the Ozark Folk Center in Mountain View marked their first professional appearance in a decade. A friend of the Armstrong family had spotted a reissue album of the twins' old four-star material in a record store and sent them a copy. Another recording session was then arranged that fall by archivist Chris Strachwich, who had re-released the original album. And the Armstrong twins, who were perhaps born too late to enjoy the commercial peak of the brotherly country harmonies of the 1930s and 1940s that they embodied, did get to enjoy an even rarer moment, a late career renaissance. Music researcher Dr. W. K. McNeil, who died in 2005, conducted the never-before-aired interview with the Armstrong twins heard in this episode in 1979. Arkansongs airs it with special thanks to Mountain View's Ozark Folk Center.
You know I will wait. But remember these words, it's never too late, it's never too late.
Here in its entirety are DeWitt natives Floyd and Lloyd Armstrong, the Armstrong twins, also of Little Rock, with Beetle with the Boogie Beat.
There's that Beetle with a brand new band, sharp as a needle and a house full of ants. Got a lot of limb and it's really quite neat. Well, they got it from the Beetle with a boogie boogie beat. Got the notion, got the motion from the Beetle with a boogie boogie beat. Ah, oh, come on, son, pick that thing. Another one. City and it don't make sense. The grasshopper sitting on a barbed wire fence, sitting there spitting while he shakes his feet. Well, he got it from the Beetle with a boogie boogie beat. Got the notion, got the motion from the Beetle with a boogie boogie beat. Ah, come on, son. Dancing with a great big fly. They can't do it, but they sure do try. Getting up a sweat and a pouring on the heat. Well, they got it from the Beetle with a boogie boogie beat. Got the motion, got the notion from the Beetle with a boogie boogie beat. Come on, son, let's go. Grandpa's fire with a pot full of gold. Can't drink cider cause he's too darn old. Getting mighty feeble, still he grinds his wheat out. Looking for the Beetle with a boogie woogie beat. Got the notion, but not the motion from the Beetle with a boogie woogie beat.
Floyd and Lloyd, the Armstrong twins, from DeWitt and Little Rock, with The Beetle with the Boogie Beat. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of Experiment Station Studios. Producer is Keith Merks. Arkansongs, since 1998.
The Arkansas soccer team is finding the net often lately. Yesterday, the Razorbacks improved to 4-1-1 with a 7-0 win over McNeese State in Fayetteville. Arkansas has outscored the last three opponents by a combined 19-0. Arkansas next travels to Waco, Texas for a match with Baylor Thursday night. Next home match, a doozy. Arkansas hosts number one North Carolina Tar Heels Sunday at noon at Razorback Field. The John Brown University women are now 3-1 after defeating Oklahoma Wesleyan Saturday 1-0. Next, a trip to Kentucky for two matches this weekend. Next home match for JBU Saturday the 21st. The men's JBU squad 3-1 after losing to number 20 in the country, Columbia College, Saturday afternoon. The men also away from home this weekend. The JBU volleyball team split a pair of home matches this weekend, now 7-3. Friday night, JBU will host Southwestern Assemblies of God for a 7 o'clock match in Bill George Arena. The Razorback volleyball team back in Barnhill tomorrow after losing all three matches on the West Coast this weekend. That leaves Arkansas 3-3. Tomorrow night, the Razorbacks host Arkansas Pine Bluff for a 6 p.m. match. It's the last chance to see Arkansas at home for a bit. The next home match after tomorrow night, Friday, October 4th. After the UAPB match, the next seven games on the road. And the Arkansas Arts Council seeking a 2020 Living Treasure. The annual recognition is given to an artisan of traditional skills living in Arkansas. The program began in 2002. Fiddlemakers, bladesmiths, and woodcarvers have been named over the past 17 years. Nominations for the award are due by November 8th. You can find out much more at arkansasarts.org.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The Komen Ozark 12th Annual Swing for the Cure Golf Classic is Friday, September 13th at Shadow Valley Country Club in Rogers. This 18-hole scramble tournament offers morning and afternoon flights, lunch, prizes, and more. Proceeds to benefit Susan G. Komen Ozark. More information available at KomenOzark.org or 750-PINK. The Alma Performing Arts Center presents Love Letters, starring Barbara Eden and Barry Bostwick, Thursday, September 19th at 7:30 p.m. A.R. Gurney's Love Letters is a funny and emotional portrait of the love between two friends exchanging notes, cards, and letters with each other over 50 years. Tickets and information available at almapac.org or 632-2129.
And look who has stopped by. The Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, Rhonda Dillard, our underwriting director. Welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're starting another contest.
I know, I'm very
excited. Already started.
It actually has already started. It's on our website, of course, at KUAF.com. And this contest will be for two tickets to the Hillbury Music Festival, which is coming up in October. It'll be October the 10th through the 13th.
And this is tickets to go in. Do you get anything else?
Tickets to go in. Tickets for the entire week, or okay. entire 3-day weekend, sorry. And it does include car camping.
Okay.
So it's kind of nice if you want to come and camp or if you want to come and go. Either way, you should have tickets. And we may have one set. We might have two sets. We might have three sets to give away.
Okay. All right. When do you go to KUAF.com to sign up, and you have to do that by?
You have to do that by Friday, September the 27th. Try to do it before 10:30 or so. Mm-hmm. We will announce the winner during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large that day. Let me throw in a lot of the musical guests you may have heard of. We've got Railroad Earth and Leftover Salmon and the Traveling McCreys. Yeah, that'll be really good. The Dale McCreary Band, Billy Strings, Yonder Mountain String Band. A great lineup this year. There will be a tribute to Jeff Austin from his band and some friends. And my favorite name of any of the groups is Meemaw and the Squirrel Chasers.
Meemaw and the Squirrel Chasers.
Who doesn't want to see Meemaw and the Squirrel Chasers?
Nobody. Everybody wants to see them.
I mean, they should.
KUAF.com. You have until mid-morning, September 27th.
That is
and
correct.
That's when we'll get back together.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Rhonda.
Thank you.
Contributors to this edition of Ozarks included Jacqueline Froelich and Zuzana Sitek, who did reporting and gathering about solar power at the Fayetteville wastewater treatment plants. Timothy Dennis mastered our show, Scratching the Surface, written and hosted by Caitlin Ahrens, produced by Pete Hartman in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio. Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Carrollton. KUAF 91.3 is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. And oh, by the way, our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean. You can learn more at darylsean.com. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for spending part of your Monday with us. Guess what? We will be back tomorrow at noon and 7 with a brand new edition of Daily Ozarks at Large.